everybody is framing everything in terms of PTSD and trauma, and everybody has their own little Holocaust of some sort. And moving around the world and seeing what perhaps trauma, my parents, my grandparents died in the Holocaust. So I have a strong relationship, identity relationship to what is traumatic or what is true Holocaust.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Ofer Zur, speaking about what he sees as an alarming misuse of the concept of traumatization and PTSD. Ofer Zur, PhD, is a licensed psychologist and forensic consultant practicing in Sonoma, California. He's the director of the Zur Institute, which offers over 100 online courses and is one of the most extensive online CE programs for psychologists, counselors, licensed professional counselors, social workers, MFTs, and nurses. His teaching, consulting with therapists, and writing focuses on private practice issues outside managed care, ethics, standards of care, boundaries, dual relationships, and internet addiction. His books include Dual Relationships and Psychotherapy, HIPAA Friendly, Private Practice Handbook, and Boundaries in Psychotherapy. Dr. Zur has deep concern regarding the harm inflicted by dogmatic, inflexible, and ideologically rigid psychotherapeutic practices. On his articles page at zurinstitute.com, you'll find dozens of free articles, guidelines for psychotherapists, and the public. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Ofer Zur, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, Dr. Dave. It's really nice being with you.
Well, it's good to finally have a chance to interview you, especially since you've made it possible through your Zur Institute for me to offer some of my interviews for continuing education credit through the Zur Institute, of which you are the founder and director.
It's fun, you know, your interviews bring kind of more livelihood to the online education, make it a little bit more interesting, and of course, for everybody to be able to listen to it on their iPods, iPads, iPhones, on the go.
Exactly, exactly. And I certainly agree with that perception, and I'm really excited to be able to make that available to my listeners out there and to have your help in marketing that. Now, you're a person of very diverse interests, as I've got to know you, and have a very fascinating background. And one of the things that you've been writing and talking about recently is your take on post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, on the one hand, and on the other, an alarming tendency to frame everything in terms of PTSD and victimization. Do I have that right?
You know, you're absolutely right. I grew up in Israel. This is where my accent is from. And I spent work and lived in Africa, in Europe, and ended up here in California. And I noticed how easily, especially in the last 10, 15 years, kind of since the mid-90s, definitely in the new century, everybody is framing everything in terms of PTSD and trauma. And everybody has their own little Holocaust of some sort. And moving around the world and seeing what perhaps trauma, my parents, my grandparents died in the Holocaust. So I have a strong relationship, identity relationship to what is traumatic or what is true Holocaust.
Right. There's trauma and then there's trauma. Before we get into the whole victimization thing, because, and you're kind of underscoring this by talking about your grandparents, you're not denying the reality of PTSD, such as that suffered by your grandparents in the Holocaust by soldiers in war and so on, are you?
You know, I was a soldier in the war, and I faced I was wounded in the 73 war. So absolutely not. When I talk about the PTSD epidemic, I'm not talking about women who were raped in gunpoint. I'm not talking about soldiers that coming from Afghanistan or Iraq or Pakistan or whatever. Anybody wants to fight another war? It seems like they don't have enough of that. So we definitely have a true PTSD that's involved, like the DSM is required. A person experienced, witness, or was confronted with event or events that involve actual threat, threatened death or serious injury, or a threat to the physical integrity of self and others. So when people just get angry and put it under PTSD, or people got hurt feelings and they put it under PTSD, or people got even sexually harassed on the job and put it under PTSD, it's kind of, I remember being shocked about it because I lived in Africa and saw what trauma is. And you know, and also when I was in Africa, or whether it's the Far East and there are monsoons and floods and hundreds of thousands of people dying in the Philippines or whatever it is with floods, they have a different attitude about it. They don't feel necessarily victimized, or I'm not sure even often they feel traumatized.
Well, that's fascinating.
They see it as part of life. They see it as, the untouchable in India are not traumatized on a daily basis. It's part of who they are. It's part of their identity. We can say it's unjust. We can say it's unfair. We can say it's immoral. We can say all the things about it that I probably may agree or not. But we assign trauma to anybody who is angry or have some hurt feeling, and it becomes this kind of an industry. But it's really, it has to be about life-threatening event or perception of.
Well, that's interesting. You're adding a dimension here that I don't think we'll find in the in the manual, which is that the way it's framed in reality by one's life experience and life expectations seems to make a difference in terms of whether or not it will be perceived as a trauma. When you refer to the untouchables, for example, their life experience frames things such that an experience that might be traumatic to an American is not perceived as traumatic by them.
Absolutely. And whether it's a monsoon and hundreds of people drown and losing their homes, drought in sub-Sahara or the Somali desert where I lived with these people, and people die every day.
Yes.
And they didn't look, they didn't even view in the Somali desert, in these tribes that I sat with, that the loss of life was anything but part of life. They did not see, did not register to them as a traumatic event. It was part of the flow of life. 5 out of 6 or 7 kids die in the Somali desert, and somebody can say thank God because the desert cannot support. So you're absolutely right. Life experiences determine your perception and definition and reaction to what is or isn't trauma.
Okay. Well, before we get more into that, I still want to dwell on what is trauma, PTSD. I have to say that was really brought home to me very, very powerfully. You know, there have been some war documentaries. There was one called Restrepo. And I'm blocking on the name of the book, but I read the book as well. And there's a documentary running on HBO right now called War Torn. And it is so powerful. It shows dismembered bodies and so on. Truly, truly upsetting imagery, and shows how profoundly our servicemen are affected by what they go through there. And of course, there are so many dimensions of it, not just the viewing of bodies or friends blown apart, but also the sort of constant danger, the inability to know who's a friend and who's an enemy, who's an ally, who's not, etc. Now, you mentioned that you yourself served in the Israeli military.
I was a lieutenant and a paratrooper in the Israeli army.
Oh, my goodness, a paratrooper.
I was wounded in the 73 war. So we need to remember that just being exposed to a life-threatening situation that every combat is supplied with this item that identify that indeed it's a life-threatening situation, that does not by itself constitute a post-traumatic stress disorder.
Would you say that you experienced PTSD as a result of your service and being wounded?
No. Absolutely not. It was a very powerful event. I saw everything that you describe and much more in regard to death and destruction.
Why would you say not? Does it
because
something-
I because to be I'm saying that because to be suffering from a mental illness that called PTSD, it's not just what you're being exposed to.
Right.
It's the second item that it must be part of the definition is that you have involved intense fear, helplessness, horror. So it's a combination and it's affect your life in a negative way. And there's a long list of items. So I was in war. I was wounded. I saw death and destruction and of people and animal and what everything else around me, but it did not traumatize me in a way that make me mentally ill.
Yeah. Now, I guess my question is, what do you think inoculated you? I guess I have two questions. One is why not you? And two, did you see other Israeli soldiers who, in fact, you would say did suffer in that way?
There are many, many factors that goes why Second World War veterans did not have PTSD. They came home, they spent a couple of months on the boat, which was a fantastic way to debrief them and to readjust them to life. And then at the end of the day, they may have a cocktail at 5 o'clock, didn't talk to anybody about it. Rarely sometimes the grandchildren will hear some rare stories about grandfather in the war in Europe.
Right, but I have to dispute what you've just said now, that soldiers in World War II didn't suffer from it. They didn't call it PTSD at that time, you know, and it's the terminology from battle fatigue and other kinds of nomenclature has evolved. But I worked in the VA hospital system for a while and saw plenty of people that were still suffering from World War II. And in many ways, because of the silence, because of not talking to the grandchildren and trying to keep it all buried, I mean, I agree with you that probably most soldiers who returned home, maybe most did not suffer from PTSD.
That's what Arwen was referring to. And you asked me, what was the difference? So.
Yeah.
Why most of them didn't? Why most Israelis do not? Some do, some don't. And that has to do with several factors. It has to do with a cultural expectation back to the untouchable. It has to do with your spiritual orientation, mm-hmm. the culture you grow up, and your belief system, your spiritual, existential worldview. Untouchable would be the best example.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Then come a slew of other issues. I grew up personally in a culture that my mother was an existentialist. She was a psychologist, and so we grew up with Buber and Sartre at home. She didn't care for what was served on the table much, but instead of the soup of the day, we have the idea of the day. So Robert May was served for dessert on a regular basis.
Oh, wow.
So when I was in an awful situation in Gaza Strip as a young 20 years old soldier, completely unprepared, and it needed to make decisions that I believe were immoral and unjust, and ultimately left Israel because of that for moral reasons. I grew up in a household or in a culture that tried to create meaning out of trauma. Israel was born out of the ashes of the Holocaust. So they try, instead of being victims and feeling victimized, they decided we're going to get the best army in the world. Some may argue appropriately that they went too far in the right direction, but this is a different discussion altogether.
Right.
So I grew up both in a culture and a household that invited me to create meaning out of powerful life events and not to frame it as necessarily traumatic, and definitely not to frame it as a mental illness such as PTSD.
So again, the way we frame things makes a real difference.
Absolutely. So we talk about the culture. You ask me, what are the factors? Culture is a factor. Within the culture is a factor, how we frame things. Spiritual orientation is relevant. And then there probably, as you saw in the VA, some people are more resilient than others.
Yes, resilience was the word I was just going to bring up. And I was thinking that I believe Martin Seligman, the psychologist who's associated with positive psychology, has actually received money from the government to try to train soldiers in resilience. I don't know how that experiment is coming along, but I would guess that maybe it would involve some training in reframing or framing, as you suggest.
Oh, absolutely. And you can induce resilience. Zimbardo talked about it as well, and many other psychologists. There are ways that you can help people preempt events that will not end up being traumatizing. And then you have a culture like here that took September 11 and everybody was traumatized, even people who watched it on television, even though it's not. And psychologists, of course, call it PTSD because we can make money out of labeling things and more people into our practices. But you cannot diagnose PTSD to somebody who watched September 11 towers burning because they were not exposed to anything that is life-threatening. Just because they feel upset, they felt upset, does not qualify them as suffer from mental illness. It doesn't qualify. But we lose track of that for many reasons. One of them is just self-serving reasons as psychologists when we call everything PTSD. So there's a cultural issues, there are personal issues, there are educational issues around resilience, how much the culture is oriented towards meaning, the spiritual belief of the culture, as well as economic forces, such as what we see as the psychology profession, call everything PTSD, just because it can gain so much financial economic benefits. And so does the pharmaceutical companies too.
Yeah, psychology and the pharmaceutical. So you are indicting our own profession, yours and mine, as having a financial stake and creating a kind of PTSD industry. You indict the pharmaceutical companies, psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers.
And add to the list, the PTSD industry is run also not only by the pharmaceutical industry, the mental health, behavioral health people, but also by the attorney who filing lawsuits and claiming PTSD for New York school teacher who was tardy for a year and a half and was fired, and then he got PTSD for being fired. So no responsibility, kind of the lack of responsibility by these three groups of organization or professions that are indeed likely to benefit financially from calling everything that moves and talks PTSD. But what's so important to understand that there are true people who are traumatized. Again, children who face extreme sexual and physical abuse, women who are being raped violently, soldiers. There are situations that indeed people face. Sometimes life car accidents will qualify under life-threatening.
What would your message then be to fellow psychologists, fellow mental health professionals, given what you've said, that there is genuine PTSD out there, but there's also stuff maybe that masquerades as PTSD. What would you hope to see as a result of what you're saying?
I hope to have some more reflection about our own self-interest. Mm-hmm. We talk about fellow therapist and mental health professional, and we need to stick with the DSM diagnosis that it must involve an experience of actual or threatened death or serious injury. So it's not ifs and buts. We just need to be honest and we need to be professional. Then perhaps my advice will be to remember that different people respond to traumatic events such as September 11. It was a true trauma for the people in the towers because they face threatened to death and serious injury for sure. And many of them died. That some people who survive this situation cannot and do not benefit from debriefing. They do not benefit from talking about it.
No, in fact, I think there's some evidence that at least in some cases, talking about it makes it worse.
Absolutely. Talking about it is can re-trigger unnecessary brain pathways that are not necessarily to be triggered and to cause anxiety and depression and fear and agoraphobia and whatever they do. Some people, we need to find out. Some people may need to go for a walk and talk. Some people need to talk in the office in a traditional way. Some people may need to have some body work. Some people need to do some dream work, and some people need to do nothing. When my wife is upset about something, what she does, she goes and meditate.
So you're really saying that the treatment approach needs to be individualized.
Exactly. She's not a woman that needs to be talked. And if you locked her into a place where she needs to talk to another human being, this will be traumatizing on its own. Give her two dogs, two cats, and a meditating couch, and she'll process her thing very well. Thank you.
Yeah, yeah. Now, one of the things that you've talked and written about are trends in diagnosis. That's another element here, isn't it?
Trendy diagnosis, yeah.
Some diagnoses are fashionable during different periods of time.
It's so true. You know, we used to have in the 80s, if you remember, everybody was kind of a borderline.
Yes, yes.
And then we have the child abuse epidemic. And then kind of in the 20th century, kind of there have been many more other trends. The eating disorder had, and the multiple had its years of claim to fame. And then since September 11 and towards the end of the 20th century, the PTSD is really becoming big. And of course, next to it, this day and age is a bipolar disorder. So now we see sometimes young children as 1 or 2 years old being diagnosed with bipolar. And you can imagine who makes money out of this kind of diagnosis. And so the ADHD also, who makes money of diagnosing every child who is spirited, who has a lot of spirit or doesn't go along with his abusive parents as ADHD, somebody makes money out of that too. So we have trends in diagnosis, which shows us that it's really maybe economic factor, maybe kind of a professional factor rather than the nature of humankind.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think one of the courses in your Zur Institute was built around the writing of Charles Sykes, a author of a widely acclaimed book, A Nation of Victims, that came out in 1992. I haven't read that book, but it sounds like his argument is very much along the lines of what you're saying. Tell us a bit about Why are we a nation of victims?
Yeah, you know, he called it a nation of victims, and definitely I kind of wrote similar pieces of writing, and where I identify kind of how everybody is a victim of some sort. And if you add all the people who are victims of sexual abuse and physical abuse and spouse abuse and bosses abuse and internet abuse, whatever it is, you probably get to have a few thousand percent of the population is being somehow as a victim. And again, it ties to what we said before, the untouchables do not perceive yourself as victims. The people that I saw in Somalia that died from the drought did not perceive themselves as victims. And I didn't perceive myself as victim in the Middle East wars that I was involved. And so are the people in Siberia that have a minus 40 degrees and many people die, do not see themselves as victims. So here, in it's not even the West, because Europe is different. In the United States, somehow, if it goes like that, something that you don't like happened to you, and something that you don't think it should happen to you, because Americans have the sense about constitutional right to be happy, to pursue happiness. So if you cannot pursue your happiness, you got violated, your constitutional right was violated, and there it must be bad, it must be wrong. It's not just shit happened, sorry for the language, it just something is wrong. And then we are looking to who to blame. So of course, psychologist Freud on blame mothers, and later on, men were to blame, government, car companies, military-industrial complex, or even our genes. So we don't like something that happens to us. That must not be right. We need to blame somebody. And once we blame them and we have a target, we call their attorney and combination of mental health people and lawyers, you have a nice package of lawsuits. So this is our way to deal with things that we don't like. And PTSD being introduced in court very, very loosely just for somebody who was angry for being harassed, being fired for not showing up, or for a speed ticket, whatever it is, parking ticket, whatever it is, that kind of being called a bad name. So we become indeed a nation of victims, where everybody is leapfrogging over everybody else, competing to the status of victims. And by that, we are really reducing, or we are missing on the true victims amongst us.
Okay. You know, we say don't blame the victim. Some people might think that you are blaming these people who are claiming to be victims.
I move away from blame or not blame, but I'm definitely look at responsibility. And I have a scale in my online course on victimhood. In my articles, I have a scale. A child who is being sexually or physically abused is innocent, has bear no responsibility. But I go to a controversial issue here. A woman who married a fifth man who abused her and dated another 10 men who abuse her physically and sexually and whatever else, but whatever reason that she does it, she is not as innocent as the young child who is at the mercy of his abuser. She making conscious choice to marry abusive men again and again. It's not that she's responsible to the violence that occurred to her, but she is responsible to her choices. So I'm moving away from don't blame the victim or blame the victim to understand how victims contribute. I was arrested one time in Zambia when Zambia did not have a relationship with Israel. Israel was helping Rhodesia to fight Zambia. I was in the wrong place and the wrong time, and I was arrested. And my question for myself, what the hell was I doing there? It wasn't right that I was arrested. It was a very, very terrible experience. I got hysterically blind and I didn't know where I was. It was really bad. Mm-hmm. But when I came out, or while I was there, I said, what the hell were you thinking when you went to Zambia without any relationship to Israel? I didn't have an American passport at the time. And I took responsibility. If you, as a white man, Dave, go to Harlem at 2 o'clock in the morning and get robbed, you are not responsible for the people who robbed you or you got hurt, but you are responsible for being dumb enough to go to Harlem at 2 o'clock in the morning or to East Oakland, whatever the place will be.
Yeah.
Know that you should have known. So I'm moving away from blame or not blame to see what level of responsibility people should take.
I like that idea of a scale, and it makes sense to me. What about the courts? I know sometimes you've been an expert witness, have you not?
I've been expert witness numerous times and on many times on issues of PTSD and victimization. The problem with the courts, it's a yes and no.
Right, that's what I was going to say, black and white in the.
And I have a scale that goes from completely innocent, the way I describe as a child, to number two, the woman who married for the fifth time another abuser, all the way to people who are 100% responsible for their violent action or whatever action that they had. So I have a scale of 1 to 5. Like, for example, teenagers who play the chicken game are at number 3. They are equally responsible for the hurt or damage they cause to each other and to themselves, because they are both participant, informed participant in an activity that has high likelihood of death and injury. You play the chicken game, you get in my scale number 3.
Mm-hmm.
You decided to do an armed robbery, you are at 5. You're 100% responsible if you get hurt or died. If you are a child being abused, you are at 1. You are completely innocent. If you are a woman that marry again and again another abuser, you're going to go to 2, because it's an interactive, it's familial violence.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about existentialism here. You mentioned that you kind of grew up with existentialism and the existentialist mother who was exposing you to Sartre and Buber and maybe other existentialist thinkers. In case we have listeners who are not familiar with existentialism, maybe you could sort of lay out what the sort of 2 or 3 or 4 foundational thoughts or attitudes are.
This is a very good question, Dave. It's so highly relevant to the issue of trauma and crisis. Because as I mentioned before, when my response to trauma and crisis is to take the existential view, it's not necessarily spiritual, and it's not come from a PTSD. And by approach, which I find very helpful when I work with people who are traumatized or people who are depressed, often people who are depressed, I'll ask them what existentially depletes you rather than are you clinically depressed.
But they might not know what you mean
exactly.
By existential.
And then I'll explain it to them the way I'm going to explain it to you. Existentially is a term that was developed in the 19th century that focused on the condition of human existence. So it's at the heart of existentialism is the view that that there is no inherent meaning in our lives. I'll tell you the four-legged of existentialism. First of all, there is no inherent meaning in our existence. That means we need to construct it again and again. And sometimes when we are in between constructions of meaning, we are perceived to be depressed. And that also, the fact that there is no inherent meaning in our existence, which is a non-spiritual approach, there is also no predictability or no continuity necessarily. The second pillar of existentialism is that each of us, you and I, and the listeners, have the freedom to choose. We can be moral or immoral. We can be decent or cruel. We can be good or bad. We have choices of how to conduct our lives, how to think, and how to feel. Then comes the fourth pillar, is that we need to come to terms with our mortality. And this is kind of where the main non-spiritual aspect of existentialism, that we are going to die and this will be the end of our lives as we know it. The last one is our sense of aloneness, that when we die, we can be surrounded by 30 grandchildren and children and wives and friends. But when we die, we face our own mortality alone. And it can be translated that as you and I struggling with our existential issues and get to an existential angst, existential anxiety, we are alone at this space searching for meaning.
Yes, and earlier you were talking about responsibility, and that fits into this model somewhere too as well, doesn't it?
Absolutely, because we have a choice how to respond to events that we don't like. So when I was wounded in a war or served in occupied areas, instead of being traumatized and taking medication and going to CBT therapy for the next 20 years, I asked myself the question, who am I? Why did I elect to be part of it? What is it like? What does it mean for me to be a young man? How do I want to live? How do I want to act in the future? And I chose to leave Israel. And I chose to pursue for over 10 years the psychology of enmity, to try to understand why people kill without guilt. Why I was able to be in this situation to kill without guilt. So I derived meaning. So Sam Keen and I crisscrossed the country and the world towards the end of the Cold War as part of my attempt to make meaning out of my highly stressful and traumatic war experience.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I've met Sam Keen and actually used to teach from his book on images of propaganda. I forget the title of the book.
Faces of the Enemy. Yeah.
Yes, Faces of the Enemy. And I loved all those propaganda posters that he managed to dig up. Not that I loved them, but they were so dramatically illustrative of how we turn the stranger into the enemy and try to justify killing.
Exactly. So I took this war experience and make it a meaningful experience. Whether it was my heart attack or going to Zambia and being arrested because I was so stupid and dumb and didn't see it coming, I took responsibility for this thing to try to understand, or being in the Somali desert and freaking out that the local tribes are killing themselves by polluting the only water hole, just to realize that they were not concerned about death. They had other concerns. So I took events that were powerful, traumatic, life-threatening, and was searching for meaning. And the search brought me to psychology. The search brought me to look at many issues in our culture, as well as in our field. So I took the traumatic experiences, and instead of taking medication and poor me and wasting time in therapy room, I constructed meanings around it, and hopefully help not only myself, but fellow human beings.
Well, as we wind down, is there anything else that you'd like to add?
My hope is that more therapists will look at traumatized clients and try to help them understand a few things. Understand, first of all, whether the client contributed to their own traumatization, whether they can avoid similar crises or traumatization in the future. And some crisis just coming upon us, and we need to embrace it and to take this approach to crisis. This is a chance to reconstruct meaning. Because in existentially speaking, crisis is when you lost your sense of meaning in the world, and you need to reconstruct it again and again and to normalize this process. Come to terms with death, come to terms with our sense of aloneness, and owning the responsibility that you make choices, whether you admit to them or not. And I think if therapists will look at crisis and trauma, when appropriate, through the existential prism, will be able to help people develop a sense of efficacy and strength and hope and resiliency, rather than a sense of poor me, I'm a victim and I've been traumatized. I'm being owed and I'm damaged for life.
All right. Well said. You've given us some good food for thought here. Dr. Ofer Zur, thanks for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
More than welcome, Dave. It's always a pleasure to talk to you on the radio and off the radio.
This is Dr. David Van Nuys of shrinkwrapradio.com. I hope you enjoyed this interview with Dr. Ofer Zur. As you heard in the interview, Ofer has made it possible for me to offer two courses through the Zur Institute based on other recorded interviews. You can earn 4 CEUs by signing up for my series on dreams, and you can earn 6 CEUs for my series of interviews on positive psychology. You'll find these at zurinstitute.com. I'm especially appreciative of Ofer for making this possible, and with his help, there will be more such courses based on my Shrink Wrap Radio interviews to come. I always find Ofer very stimulating. As with other Israelis I've met, and I hope I'll be forgiven the generalization, Ofer is a man of very strong opinions. He's someone who challenges much of the conventional thinking of psychology. He's argued forcibly against some of the ethical standards in the APA Code of Ethics, and as a result, he's not only brought about changes, but also was elevated in APA to the status of fellow. His observation in this interview that the PTSD diagnosis is being overgeneralized and overused is an example of the sort of useful challenge that is typical of his style. Personally, I think it's a timely caution. His notion that there might be a continuum of victimhood / responsibility is novel and intriguing. I personally very much resonate with his eclecticism as a therapist and with his existential stance in relation to crisis and trauma. I myself have been very influenced by the humanistic existential approach as developed by Dr. James Bugenthal. I would particularly recommend for your consideration his books, The Search for Existential Identity and Psychotherapy and Process. And his book, Psychotherapy Isn't What You Think, is available to read for free on Google Books.